You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 472. John's on the phone, Adam's on the internet, Tom's on vacation, Hallie's at work. So we're spread all over, and this intro is not going that well. But listen, it's the Punk News Podcast. Let's get this party started. Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. Adam, it might be a shorter episode tonight because, not a nil week this week, but, you know, kind of a standard week, nothing crazy. I've got some existential questions that I'm going to throw at you, I think, because I think people like to hear about that, or maybe they don't. But, Adam, how are you feeling? We're now beyond Thanksgiving, Canadian and American, if you will. Christmas is on the horizon. I think Diwali already happened. But Hanukkah's on the horizon, if that's your thing. Let's see what else. The holy month for Muslims is early next year. And Ramadan. That's right. I couldn't think of Ramadan. If you're Buddhist, it's always a nice time. You know. If you're Baha'i, that was last month, 200th anniversary of the Baha'i faith, Adam. Let's see what else. Cow die.
Do the Scientologist worship Xenu, or is he just kind of like an
antagonist? No, he's a bad guy. First of all, we better be careful because apparently Scientologists really still are a threat. But Xenu is the bad guy. Are you being funny? Do you not know?
Because I just want to know, is there any Xenu related shenanigans in the month of December?
So no, Scientologists strictly do not talk about Xenu, and unless they're of a certain level, and this is all kind of the semi sketchy, like Scientology exposed things that I used to read, but don't read it too much anymore. But anyways, so Scientologists believe. So here's the story. If you haven't seen South Park,
I have. So what I want to know, here's what I'm driving at, John, is two questions. Was one, was there any holiday in December that was related to Scientology that we should acknowledge for all of our Scientologist listeners out there?
I don't think they have holidays because they say they're not Scientologists always say we're not a religion, we're a life skills development association.
Cool. So then question B, extension to this, could we become like Xenuists? Like Satanists?
Wow. Adam, I don't know if anyone's ever thought of that before, but that's like a really funny and clever idea. However, it might also get us murdered. The Catholic Church isn't going to murder you for worshiping Satan, but the Scientology have made people disappear or at least have harassed people to a significant degree. Question and point. Hey, here's something crazy about Scientology, Adam. Check this out. David Miscavige, however you ever say his name, the main Scientology, Adam, he grew up like a half a mile from my house. He went to the high school where some of my friends went. He went to the same high school that some of my cousins went to. I mean, 20 years before. That's crazy. No one ever told me this.
Well, see, now we should get off this topic because you're way too close.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Man, I mean, have you ever read not to become the anti-Scientology podcast, but like you read about some of these kids that like got out of Scientology and you're like, how could your parents ever subject your children to that thing? And actually, Adam, the segue is great in the first topic I wanted to discuss tonight. We will touch the news, but I've got a couple existential questions.
Yes.
So Adam, you're a dad, you're a father. So give me your perspective on this. I'm a huge Frank Zappa fan, And one of the many cool things about Frank Zappa is in the 80s, when the PMRC was rising, and at the same time, Frank Zappa was under fire for being immoral. Specifically, I forget the senator's name, but also Jerry Falwell, the TV mega preacher, specifically targeted Zappa and was attacking him. And of course, about a year or two later, and during the battle, if you will, Jerry Falwell was caught with a prostitute in his limousine. And so during the whole time, Zappa was he actually did a whole tour called Broadway the Hard Way, where the whole tour was almost like a GWAR show, where they made fun of Jerry Falwell the whole time, and Jerry Falwell came out, well, not the real one, but like a caricature, and they made fun of him, and they insulted him, and that kind of a thing. There's a famous video that you can watch on YouTube of Frank Zappa in Congress, where he's fighting against the PMRC with John Denver and Jello Biafra, and Zappa's stance, and pretty much in all of the 80s, Zappa's big stance was you can't legislate morality. The Constitution does not give you the authority to legislate morality. And even more so, you're an immoral guy. You're a creep. I'm not the creep. You're the creep. And during one of the congressional hearings, one of the senators is like, well, Mr. Zappa, don't you look, you know, what when you select your children's toys, don't you, you know, decide if they're appropriate or not? Trying to draw a parallel between that and the PMR, the tipper sticker. And Frank Zappa's response is, well, I don't buy toys for my children, so I can't speak to that. And I always thought that was a really clever debate tactic. Like what father hasn't bought toys for their kids? You know, Adam, you've bought toys for your kids, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So more than 2 years ago, but I've been thinking about this ever since. About 2 or 3 years ago, a documentary came out called Eat That Question. And it's all Frank Zappa interviews from the 60s through the 90s. And I think some people knew about this, but it was kind of a minor revelation. And that Frank Zappa, even though he was married to Gail Zappa and had kids, he was actually banging groupies all the time. And he actually even had a mistress that lived in the same house with him and his wife and kids. And Zappa and this is kind of like they admit to this. Zappa and his mistress lived on the top floor and Gail Zappa and the kids lived on the bottom floor. And I got to say, Adam, it really bummed me out because I don't know, like I don't know if Zappa can take the moral stand if he's got a mistress in the house with his kids. It's one thing to be cheating on your wife, which is incredibly lame, but it's even more so to be doing it like right in front of the kids. And it isn't even cheating if your wife knows about it. You know what I mean? At any rate, how do we view Zappa, you know, Mr. – you know, I'm fighting for – I'm the moral one. You know, Jerry Falwell is the immoral one. I'm not saying Jerry Falwell is a good guy. But does Frank Zappa lose some credibility as the free speech and morality, I guess, counter defender when now that we know that he had a mistress in his house, you know, at least in the 80s and maybe even in the 70s. And not only that, it really did cause his family problems because after he died, his two sons and I think the daughter really hated each other for a while. And they sued the shit out of each other. And it only got cleared up recently. And the mother didn't even speak to one of the kids, which is total BS, too, mind you. I mean, how do we view Zappa and that kind of thing in this new development, I guess, or this new light?
Well, the risk there is that you conflate the academic and moral stance that, say, like Zappa was taking during a statement to Congress with what's going on in his personal life. And if you separate them, which I think that you probably should, then whatever crazy things we learn about Frank Zappa's personal life shouldn't matter too much, because if the principled argument that he would be trying to make with regards to what the PMRC was doing at the time shouldn't be dependent on the individual, right? Like he should be arguing for rights and for lack of, say, like government interference in the arts and things like that, in a way that shouldn't matter what Frank Zappa in particular is up to in his bedroom or not. Because in a way that's sort of what we want, right? It's like, is we want to have rules that apply because the rule is just and makes sense. And if the rule can be undermined because, oh, it turns out that the guy that was advocating for the rule, you know, had all these personal problems, then that rule doesn't seem all that strong in the first place. It seems more tied to the individual, which is probably what we don't want. Is that a cop-out answer? I feel like that's not, but
I feel like it's not, and I think I agree with it, but it's a huge bummer that, you know, Mr. Righteous, you can't tell me what is and is not moral, is doing something that's objectively not moral. I mean, is there any way to say what he's doing is moral? I can't see it.
This is the problem, you know what I mean? This is the problem with having with having heroes or having like an individual that becomes the figurehead of a movement or anything like that. Because it's counterproductive then, because as soon as something comes out where they've done something like this, then it immediately gets flipped around and thrown against them as if it invalidates the things that they were trying to say. I mean, John, you saw this today, right? And not to date the show any more than we already date the show, but today was the what was it? The
was the hearings before the U.S. House Judiciary Committee from a quartet of constitutional scholars about you know whether it's right to move ahead with impeachment or not, right? Like that was today. So you have these four people there that are constitutional scholars. They're not all arguing the same point, right? I mean, like three of them kind of were, and one of them was arguing the other side, but they're all making academic arguments about, you know, what they see is going on. But then you look at some of the back and forth from the House representatives that were sitting on there, particularly the Republican ones, where they're basically like throwing back at these people, like, oh, like at one point they asked all of them, you know, can you put your hand up if you voted for Donald Trump? And then at another point they went and they challenged one of the professors that was there, because it was like in the public record that she had donated to, you know, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren or something like that. And it's like, well, hold on, if you can't separate the academic argument that these people are making, the higher principle that they're trying to argue for, from whatever personal views that they have, then how do you go through life trusting anything? Because then everyone that you encounter then can never just make a pure argument. They all have to be coming from a state of, you know, potential antagonism to whatever team you're on. And like, what a shitty way to live, right? Like what a shitty way to interact with the world, where you can't take anything then at face value. You can't take, you know, like any principle just as an argument in and of itself without having to pick apart the human being that said it. Like, that sucks. So, you know, I mean, I get what the you know, Republican members are trying to do there, right? Like, they're trying to argue for their team and all that. But still, like, you got a bunch of people there making an academic argument. You're going to ask them all to put their hand up if they voted for the president or not. Like, ugh, that's just gross.
Well, not to get too political, but I mean, that's been the Republican strategy for the past three years has been the exact same thing. A, you know, attack bias, even if one doesn't exist, or try to conflate it. Or when you're accused of something, you say, no, I didn't do X, you did X. But regardless of that, is maybe though, this goes back to music reviews. Is there such a thing as a truly objective music review? The answer is no. You know, you can try to be objective, but no one can be truly objective for a music review. And so I don't know if – and listen, I think it was quite clear that the three constitutional scholars that were brought as witnesses by the Democrats, I think their arguments were much more sound, mind you, whereas the Republican scholar basically said, oh, well, we need to do more due process, you know, and slow it down. It's like, all right, whatever, dude. Anyways, the point being is I don't know if anyone truly can be – I mean, is there anyone that can be truly, truly objective, or by knowing their biases, can we use that bias not to totally discredit what they're saying, but to see where their argument's coming from and, I guess, weigh it in that context?
I feel like, I don't know, like the ideal in any of these situations is like we should be able to acknowledge what our biases are, but still like hold that in one hand and then like hold the principle in the other. It's like, John, like if you that's not a rear end is not a good dude. All right, let's say you were pulling into a parking space and you bumped the car next to you, right? Your bias, your self-interest, let's say, should be that, you know what, you get in your car and you leave and you pretend that never happened and just like, you know, woof, like that was a stupid thing that you just did. Sorry, guy, but John's getting out of here, right? But on the other hand, you know, you want to be able to say that like you are a, you know, quote unquote, good enough person that you'd be like, well, like I fucked up. I'm going to stick around and, you know, and rectify this problem that I caused. You know, where you can take the view where, you know, here's objectively what should happen right now, and here is, you know, how it personally helps or harms me, and kind of like have both things present in your life, in your composition or whatever, and move ahead in the world like that. But I don't know, maybe that's just not the way people want it.
Life isn't quite as usually is not quite, especially in this context, in the constitutional context, it's never simple. But life is not quite as simple as that example. I think maybe a better example would be, just, what if you bump into a guy, but he's driving drunk, and if he wasn't drunk, you wouldn't have bumped into him in the first place. You know what I mean? So I don't know if it's always that simple, you know.
That's where you put on your Batman cowl and go kick that guy's ass because he shouldn't be doing that.
Listen, driving drunk is – I'm sorry. I have no sympathy for people who get caught driving drunk. In the age of – I just got Uber. No, I got Lyft. I got Lyft for like the first time a year ago. In the age of Lyft, there's like no excuse to drive drunk at all. You know what I mean?
No, that's the thing too. I mean like and the – there's – it's like it's astonishingly selfish in a way because it's like it's almost like lazily selfish. Like with the like even if you don't live in a city that has like prominent like a prominent enough population that you have all those ride sharing services, like there's ways to figure it out, right? Like there's I mean like Niagara is a pretty good example for that where like we don't have Lyft around here. We just recently got Uber, but it's not super great because there's not a ton of population compared to the amount of drivers and all that. But even if you couldn't do that, this town is full of sketchy ass, you know, quasi-legal, you know, you pay them some money and they come pick up your car and drive it home for you kind of services. And even when you can't get those, you do what I did last week, John, which was that you call your brother up and you say, Carl, you asshole, what are you doing tonight? And he goes, why? And you say, you're driving me to this restaurant because I want to have a bunch of beers. That's what you do. And if you can't do that, then you should probably figure it out before you go get yourself in that situation.
Well put, Adam, well put. And this podcast is off to a very deep and philosophical bend, but that's what we do sometimes.
Well, because that's where you threw it. Like, do we not have any mail yelling at us about My Chemical Romance? Well,
in case some of the listeners have been watching the site has had a little bit of problems lately. one of those problems is I'm locked out of my email. Adam, did you have this? Did you get locked out of your email? Because I think I'm the only guy that did for some reason.
Well, this is because you said that those things about Scientology.
It is. Google thinks I'm some kind of Scientologist, like conspiracist or anti-conspiracist or something. So I got locked out of my Gmail and I'm waiting for all but unlocking. So you can reach the podcast at punknews.org, but we're not going to read any mail this week. So take that, internet listeners.
I have it on good authority that a certain listener who writes into our show fairly frequently, whose name will remain hidden to protect them, took issue with the comments that that you myself and Tom made about how we don't really have anything to say about My Chemical Romance because we're too old. And this individual, let's call him Nottingham Nigel. He apparently admitted to being fond of said eyeliner clad band for preteens and said that our whole stance on being too old doesn't hold the mustard, but that's not a phrase, you know, doesn't cut water, John. So I'm, you know, maybe we'd get that email if we get the email, but we can't.
I mean, maybe we'll get it next week, but honestly, Adam, it's difficult to imagine a world in which I care about my Chemical Romance. You know?
I don't know. We're just depriving ourselves. All right. So, yeah. All right. So, we have no mail. Oh, although I did. I gotta dig this out because I was I'm always impressed when this happens because we don't, outside of the email, we don't necessarily make it super easy to contact us if for no other reason than we don't tell people how to contact us and they just have to figure it out on their own. Like those organized podcasts that tell you things. So we're not one of those, but someone reached out to me. They sent me a personal message on one of the social networks I despise, but I'm stuck with. And I can't find the message because these things are not great to use. But in any case, it was a person of the UK persuasion, and they said, "Adam, your crazy ass Canadian read on the libertines that I voiced a few weeks ago, not actually, yes. not actually so crazy." Pretty actually on the money from the standpoint of this person who is a genuine of the Isles lad. So there you go.
What was your stance that they were the last great rock band or something?
No, that's a little bit extreme. No, I mean, I was just expressing that, like, as in the early 2000s, I had this sort of, like, this period of fascination with them, but I was worried that if you were actually from the UK, they were just, like, the most insufferable pop band, and, you know, and anyone who really wanted to talk about rock and roll would have kind of like, you know, was just like acting like a clown by even engaging with them. I was worried that was going to be the case but I would lose all that context coming at it from this side. But no, turns out that my read, whatever it was, go back and listen to the past archives of the show, whoever, was pretty good. So yeah, thanks individual for reaching out to me on Instagram there and telling me that, because that was...
You're on Instagram?
That's pretty sure. I'm on Instagram. I am bad at it.
Oh,
I'm
man.
Super bad at it. Here's how bad at it I am. I posted a picture of my kids making pizza on November 22nd. Right now it's December 4th. And then before that, I posted a picture of a tree on October 21st. And then before that, I posted a boring picture of my record player and some pictures of my kids picking apples. Like, I am the worst. I am infrequent at it. I don't necessarily like taking pictures of things. And so I create this like anemic feed of nonsense for no one. And I totally resent the idea of an Instagram story, and I refuse to make them. So yeah. I'm just batting a thousand. Like,
everybody's on Instagram these days, and like you can now you can only read Instagram for like 30 seconds if you're not a member, and then it like blocks you out. I think I might have to join Instagram. I've already got Facebook and Twitter. I don't want another one, but everybody's on Instagram now, man. I hate this.
What I can't deal with is that I always want to engage with these things in the way that they were assembled originally. And I have no interest in the way that the companies want me to use it now, or not even the companies. In some cases, the companies, but like I can't deal with the way that like the people are using it now. So Twitter for me is like, Twitter has always been my natural place where I would go on the internet to converse with the universe. Like that's my home base. If I had to delete everything else, I would always have said that, you know, the Twitter account's the only one I care about. Well, the problem is that like I still want to use Twitter like people were using Twitter 5 years ago, which is that, like, I want to go post little quippy things or little weird life observations or whatever, and then have people react to them. But you go on there and it's just like people just, it's either one of two things. It's people making memes nonstop, just making memes. Like, I'll go on there right now and there's like 500 pictures of Baby Yoda. And I'm just like, I can't deal with the memes, but that's all they're doing. They're all trying to out-meme each other. I don't want to do that. I refuse, John. I refuse to meme. It's going to be my tombstone.
I approve. I actually think meme, like, maybe didn't start that way, but I actually think meme is almost like a tactical way to dumb down the population and limit their expression. Like, you can't, like, do your own thing anymore. You can only communicate. Actually, the Sonic Attack. Here, Adam, check this out. What you keep talking, I'm going to pull out the flyer I handed out to Sonic Attack, and I'm going to read a line from it. But keep okay, talking.
Right. I steadfast refuse to meme because I always feel like, I have to say this because there's a lot of people that I like that do these things, but like, I feel like I'm stupid. Like, I feel like I'm doing something that is dumb for both, like, dumb for my own sake in terms of like all the things that I could be doing in the universe. You know, like how like a podcast throwback here to where I was saying I only have like 4 slots for things in my life or whatever the fuck it was. I can't fill one of those slots with making memes, right? Like, that's just a waste of my time, right? But I feel like I'm doing that. But then I also feel that weird pressure where you look and it's just like, oh, everyone's jumping on the next funny meme format. And I'm like, I don't want to feel the pressure to go jump on something. Like, I don't want to have to go participate in this thing just because everyone else is doing it. It feels like lemming shit. So I don't want to do that either. You know, my whole thing in life was to not be going along with whatever the popular crowd is doing, right? Like, that was how I got into punk rock in high school or whatever. So I don't want to just sit here and participate in whatever the trend du jour is. That sucks. That's not my whole makeup doesn't address that. my other problem though with Twitter these days is that I'll go on and it's just like, you know, people just expressing their problems in a way that I'm sure is very cathartic and healthy for them, but I just don't know how to respond to or engage with or anything like that. Just, you know, it's like,
isn't that what we're doing right now? But B, actually, I almost wonder if it's not, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't really know, but I do feel as though, like, especially on Twitter and some other like social medias, like there's such a thing in reveling in misery and almost making pornography of misery. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I'm so sad. And then everyone's like, oh, I'm sorry that you're feeling bad. Well, maybe instead of like, I don't know, talking to each other on Facebook or Twitter, you should actually work to be correcting whatever issue it is that's causing you that misery instead of showboating it, if you will. I don't know. I could be off base.
I think that deep down I have a similar read on it, but I'm so worried about offending people. It's because the people that are doing it are always like, here's my litany of mental health problems or something like that. And you'll see them go on there every day and they're just like, you know, talking about their struggles and what sucks now and stuff like that. I want to talk about like how my tomatoes are doing in the garden or Hawkwind or something, right? Like I don't know how to, like you've taken the whole conversation to this place of like extreme vulnerability for you. And I'm not even fucking qualified to engage with this and I'm just not gonna. So swinging back to it though. Twitter, I just want to talk about tomatoes or whatever, and I can't because everyone's doing all that. They're doing memes or they're treating it as their therapist. Instagram, I just want to go post, you know, pictures of a band playing or my garden or whatever. But it's people are really doing that kind of thing. They're all using those Instagram stories to make these little, you know, ethereal temporary slideshows full of animated GIFs and wackiness. But even people that I know that are like, I would consider like a really serious professional artist. Like, it's like a musician that is like, you know, carries themselves with like a lot of poise and dignity. They're on there just like making memes full of, or like Instagram stories full of like goofy animated shit and sparkles and whatever else. And I'm thinking like, are they just doing that because they feel obliged? Like, that's the only way that they're going to get the message about their music out is that they participate in this silly little thing that some nerds have invented, because like, oh, that's depressing if that's the case.
Well, you're right. And that there is something to be gained from, like, you know, if you want to talk to immersive screaming females, you can do it on social media, which is cool. But on the other hand, it's like, well, no, like learning more about Iggy Pop might not be beneficial to the art that is Iggy Pop. You know, like, he's not as mysterious. But I will say, Adam, you know who's not on social media? Nick Blink of Rudimentary Peni, not on social media. And we'll get to the punk news in a second. But Adam, give me your perspective on this. So we're friends with a lot of mutual people on Twitter, and you and I have about three or four friends that love the nudie girls on Twitter. And you know how Twitter says so and so liked this, you know, and. Like, have you had this in the past couple of months? I've just had a constant stream of nudie girls because two or three of our mutual friends, man, they love clicking like on the nudie girls. And A, it's like, I don't know why you're clicking like on that for all the world to see. And B, it's like, it makes me see them in somewhat of a different light, I'll tell you.
There are definitely a handful of people that are from our mutual music acquaintance. And off air, I want to know who they are. But it seems to crop up that they interact with all that way more than I would expect a person using a public profile to do. And I don't know if I wonder is that just because like they're very modern and sex positive and I am essentially an old Italian grandmother, or is or am I right? I don't know.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, honestly, like even if they're sex positive, do we need to know who so-and-so is beating off to? Like, I don't need to know that, you know? And I almost wish I could tell Twitter, don't let me see other friends' likes. But I don't think you can do that. You know what I mean?
I know. It's just, it's trying to kill us. So we're making we're making good use of this non-show that we're apparently recording. Do you want to play a song or something? And then we can...
I'll tell you what. So anyways, Adam, you know about Sparks, the band Sparks? Oh, actually, I'm going to change my mind. I'm going to play Sparks later on because that's an old band, but I'm going to play a new band. There's this band called Clear Channel, and Clear Channel is a spinoff band of Downtown Boys. I think some of the Priests are in there. I think some of Gauche is in there, or Gauche. And so they just put out – they only got an EP out. It's just called Clear Channel. And I saw them open for Downtown Boys. Downtown Boys was amazing. But Clear Channel was, like, really amazing too. And they've got this new EP out. Speaking of sex positive, so they have, like, two kinds of songs. They've got really, really cool post-punk songs. They're, like, halfway between Gang of Four and Joy Division. And they've got, like, these super warped dance tracks. And they have two singers. The dance track singer is a guy. The post-punk Gang of Four is Mary Relegato of Downtown Boys. And Adam, do you want to hear the haunting, scary Gang of Four meets Bauhaus Joy Division track, or the hilarious weird warp dance track?
Scary.
Well, too bad, because I want to play the funny one. Actually.
All right, go ahead. I promise.
The rest of the album doesn't necessarily sound like this, but this song is just so I love this song. It's hilarious. It's called Show Me Your Bananas, and it's by Clear Channel. But they're actually a pretty serious band, but they've got some funny songs. So this is Show Me Your Bananas by Clear Channel.
I'm looking for cherries. Who has a cherry? Show me your cherry. I wanna see cherry. Is it hot, hot, hot? Hot cherry, hot, hot, hot. Hot cherry, hot, hot, hot. Hot cherry, hot, hot, hot. Hot cherry, I'm looking for bananas. Show me your banana. I wanna see banana. Two big black bananas.
Maybe we'll play the scary one at the end.
Oh, okay. We'll see what we do. All right. So let's talk about some of these things that happened this past week. So you want to start with the festivals here? Or you want to start with?
Yeah. I mean, let's see. We got a pretty free form episode tonight,
but I think my internet's back. We got Ellen Foley. What do you want to do?
I mean, none of that's super exciting. Let's talk festivals, because people say we don't talk about Rebellion Festival enough, so let's talk about Rebellion Festival and Pooza Fest, big Sam Barrett of Punk News favorite. So the details for two big festivals have been announced. One of them is Rebellion Festival, and here's who's playing Rebellion Festival this year. A number of really cool bands, and mostly older ones that a lot of people like, and people say that we don't really talk about Rebellion Fest a lot, but we do. We talk about them somewhat, and here's who's playing Rebellion Fest this year. The bands that are playing Rebellion Fest this year are Sham 69, Stiff Little Fingers, Bad Religion, Undertone, Steve Ignorant, Playing Crass, Angelic Upstarts, Anti-Nowhere League, GHB, The Dickies, UK Subs, and many more. Adam, I would say perhaps the three notable ones here. Bad Religion, and that's not notable because Bad Religion is playing a show. It's notable because Bad Religion is playing Rebellion Fest, which is almost traditionally always strictly UK bands headlining, unlike perhaps Punk Rock Bowling or Pooja Fest, which is kind of more international. Like, the headlining band could be not anywhere, but there doesn't seem to be a national bias as to who's headlining. Rebellion Fest famously has had somewhat of a bias, and now they've got Bad Religion headlining, which is interesting because I don't know if Bad Religion means what it means in the UK as what it means here. The other interesting thing, Adam, is Steve Ignorant playing Crass. Twice now, Steve Ignorant has said, I'm not playing Crass ever again. And twice he's come back and played Crass, which I'm glad he did, because I saw him the first time and it was absolutely amazing. And I'm sorry I didn't go to the Punk Rock Bowling where he did all Crass in a club show. He's gotten some heat, but at this point, I think the heat's worn off and people don't really care one way or another. If you're into it, you'll go see it. But if not, then you're not going to write to stink about it. Because I remember in Crass, there's literally protesters outside the show trying to get people to go to a Reviver show instead of seeing Steve Ignorant does Crass.
It is interesting to see Bad Religion on this bill. If for nothing else, then they... Well, you could certainly make the argument that Bad Religion shares an era, right, with a lot of these bands that were active in the early 80s. They tend to pal around with bands that are younger, right? Like, they... The career trajectory of Bad Religion made them in many ways into a band that helped foster this next generation of kind of like young Californian skate punk, you know, really obviously through the fact that, you know, that Brett owned Epitaph and, you know, helped pay for a lot of that stuff to come into existence. But just even more so than that, just like from an influence standpoint, right? Whereas you look at a lot of these other bands and they didn't have that same type of branch on, say, like the musical family tree, right? Like, while there were definitely lots of bands that were influenced by, you know, GBH or the Dickies or the UK Subs, it's not the same like economic scale of what Bad Religion was involved in. And when Bad Religion goes out and plays now, you know, they're taking bands that are generally younger than them with them, or are kind of like direct Californian contemporaries to them out. They're not playing with a lot of the UK bands that were, you know, contemporaneous across the pond back then. So it's interesting to see them in this light. I'd be curious what a GBH or an Anti-Nowhere League type person would think of Bad Religion. Like, there's a part of me that wants to say that, do they look at it and think that it's like kid stuff? And I don't know why I'd have that read on it, but just like, do they look down on it as being this more youth oriented American version of the sound compared to the harder edged, closer to the core of it UK work of it? I don't know. Where's my British people? Right in. You know.
You feel as though Bad Religion speaks to youth culture still? That's not an argument, that's a question.
Nah, I mean, I feel if I was to give you a bunch of bands that I've written on flashcards, right, mixed up and put in front of you, and I said, which of these bands are Bad Religion taking on tour? And on that list of cards, you had, say, I don't know, Off With Their Heads and Pears in that list, but then you had the Dickies and the UK Subs. You 9 times out of 10 would say, well, Bad Religion's probably going to take, you know, Off of Their Heads and Pears with them.
Just, or even like War on Women or something like that.
War on Women or something like that, right? Like they tend to be, and it might just be that, like, because they're quote unquote a bigger band, at least as far as, you know, filling a hall than maybe someone like GBH would be. But yeah, like they seem to be palling around with the younger crowd. They always sort of have in my head. And maybe that's just because Greg projects himself as like old and professorly. I don't know. But yeah, I don't see them when I close my eyes being one of these old guard bands, even though they were certainly active at, you know, at that same time. What's your read on? Yeah, like, what do you feel there?
I think the English audience is somewhat more territorial. The American, like in America, we're like, oh, you know, we love Crass or we love the Damned, you know. But I think American bands in England aren't quite as greeted with open arms. And I think it really goes back to long have the English said, you know, the Sex Pistols and the Clash and the Damned were the first punk bands. But I think it's pretty easy to disprove that. Disprove that with the Ramones. And with Suicide, you know, with the Stooges. And so I'm not trying to start a flame war here, but I do think that's always sort of a sore spot. And it's like when people go visit, say, Salt Lake City, like there's always like, Salt Lake City is a happening place. You should come visit Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City is the best place to come. We got a lot of cool stuff. And you don't see that in LA. You don't see that in San Francisco because they don't need to, because they know they're top ranking. So they don't need to defend themselves because they know they're winning. Whereas with England, I think that is somewhat of a sore spot. And so I think Bad Religion will, not that they'll be seen as a kiddie thing, but I think they'll be seen as almost like not artsy fartsy, kind of like Ivory Tower, you know, whereas UK subs. And even Crass is talking about the real street level things, and Bad Religion is just some pretty boys that are singing about, you know, something they read in a textbook. I think that's the view, you know. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how it comes off, but I actually think Bad Religion might be. I mean, listen, it's not going to be a riot or anything, but I think the audience reaction will not be as big for Bad Religion as the organizers think, particularly because so much Bad Religion lyrics is so uniquely American-centric. And the interesting dynamic is when I listen to Crass or even Sham 69 or Clash or and they're like, you know, we, you know, Thatcher, we hate her, she's the worst, and I'm like, yeah, I hate Margaret Thatcher, yeah, I don't feel as though the English people, when they hear, you know, a band singing about American politics, I don't think they're like, yeah, well, they might with Trump, you know, but like if we say George Bush, I don't think the English audience would be like, yeah, George Bush, let's kick him out. Like, I think they just don't care, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think there's less. So the interesting dynamic is with the Americans listening to English stuff, there's more dress up, you know, it's like, yeah, I hate Thatcher, where as on the English side, it's more, this doesn't apply to me, so I don't care. Even though I think England is somewhat sore with regards to the founding of punk rock itself. That's my scholarly thesis.
That's not a bad thesis there. We'll throw that on the pile of the 40-year argument people have been having about that. Let's talk about the Undertones just for a sec here, because they're playing this. They're playing Rebellion. But they're also touring the States. So they're going to be headed out on the on the east coast of the U.S. in April of 2020, and then they'll be returning back to the U.K. in May and June to tour around there. So the Undertones, they were originally active from 74 through to 83, and then they were formed in 1999 and have been active since. And while I feel like I knew that, I have zero recollection of hearing any post-reformation Undertone song. So the little tag that was in the article that we posted here that says that their most studio album was called Dig Yourself Deep and came out in 2007. Did you hear that record?
I honestly, Adam, I had no idea that after like the early 80s. I had no idea. I knew they were like touring once in a while, but I had no idea they released new material.
I know. Like, I feel like this is like, if anyone should know this, it should probably be us. But I had no idea that that there was Undertone stuff after the reunion, and I'm now kind of curious to go find it. If only because that is a band that had such like to me, more so even than the Buzzcocks, like the Undertones is the sound of youth, right? Not just because Teenage Kicks is called Teenage Kicks, and right, but just like it is a band that just just vocally just wore the fact that they were kind of like young, scrappy upstarts on their sleeves. And I don't know if I can hear those songs coming out of someone that's 65.
Yeah, well, but except for the Buzzcocks were kind of convincing when they did it.
Yeah, but the weird thing is, like, when the Buzzcocks got back together, they recorded all these songs that were way heavier than anything that the Buzzcocks would have done. I keep saying the Buzzcocks, but I should just be saying Buzzcocks, right? But like, they were way heavier sounding to me than anything that you would, you know, consider to say like a Singles Going Steady, you know, style track. So like, that was a little bit, not off-putting is not the right word, but it was noticeable when they got back together, when they released that self-titled full length, which I'm a huge fan of, right? I remember listening to a song, like, say, like Sick City Sometimes, or Sick City Sometimes. Yeah, let's call it that, from that record at first, and just thinking like, oh man, like there's some gravel in the vocals of the Buzzcocks right now. Like, that is not, that's not what I'm expecting. Like, that's a far cry from, you know, What Can I Get, an Orgasm Addict, or whatever, right? Which are songs that are just like, you know, pegged right at the top of this like squeaky high range. So, but I got over that because all those Buzzcocks records were great. The Undertones, I imagine that I could totally end up with the same end up in the same place, but I can't can't picture it.
Well, the thing for me, and I'm gonna say, for me, the Undertones are like Cheap Trick. Like, everyone says they're so great, and then when I listen to them, I was like, oh, this is kind of boring. You know, like, maybe they got like one song that's cool, but the rest is just like there's not enough snap in it for me.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to figure this out. Now, I should I should make this clear, and maybe this will be what really drives home this. I'm just confirming that I am not going to step in this fact. I'm not. Okay. The OG Undertones, like the ones that we that we're thinking of really when we're thinking of Teenage Kicks, Virgil Sharkey was the singer to that band at the time. Really up through the whole original run, up through 83. When they reformed, they did not reform with him. So he kept out of it. Paul McClune is the band's vocalist now. And he was asked to join the group and accepted and became kind of their new frontman and new lead singer when the band got back together. Now, I know nothing of McClune sonically, so beats me how he handles that material, but it's a different guy. So that's a little bit different than the Buzzcocks situation.
Yeah, well, I'm even less interested, I hate to say it, but here's something that I'm really not interested in either, but a lot of people are excited for, and I'm not trying to be negative Nancy here. Pooja Fest, perhaps the contrast to Rebellion Fest, which is basically older bands. Pooja Fest has got a lot of semi-new and I guess not that old bands. Good Riddance, John Snodgrass, but the Penske Files, Brutal Youth, Dig It Up, Mockingbird, Wish Me Luck, Horace Pinker, the reunion of Tightrope.
Can I give the context for this one, since I actually know who these bands are?
Yes, by all means.
So Pooja is a downtown Montreal based punk festival, one of those like multi venue punk festivals. In a lot of ways, modeled after the Fest, because so many of the bands that founded Pooja and played Pooja were bands that would go down and play Fest. So that festival's back. It's its 10th year in 2020. The thing runs from May, 15th, 16th, and 17th. So this being its 10th year, the organizers are trying to reach out and pull in as many kind of past performers that that have played it to bring them back. And they're throughout the month of December, they're announcing like a chunk of bands every week leading up till Christmas. I think they're just doing sort of like one blast a week, so there might be like four announcements there. So last year there was it was like 175, 180 bands that played Pooza. Like it's a big multi-venue event. There's tons of shows. You couldn't, you know, there's tons of shows, and there's no real main stage either. There's a couple bigger venues that are in downtown Montreal, like Club Soda or something like that, that would be used for the bigger bands playing. But it's always seemed like less centralized, let's say, than a lot of festivals that I've been to. So the bands, John rattled through some of them that are playing this thing. If you take this first announcement, I'm going to break it into three groups for you here. The first was that you had these U.S. bands that have played Pooza before that they're bringing back up north of the border. So, you know, you've got, you know, veterans like Good Riddance, Missouri's John Snodgrass is coming in, the Chicago punk band Horace Pinker. You know, those are the American ones that have been announced so far. Then you've got a bunch of Canadian bands, some of which have been kind of inactive for a little while, that are coming back to play this year. You've got, you know, the Penske File from Burlington. They're kind of like an anthemic melodic punk three piece. Hardcore Act, Brutal Youth, the Montreal Punks, Dig It Up, who I'm not super familiar with. Mockingbird, Wish Me Luck was kind of a no idea style emo sounding band that was out of Kitchener, Ontario, that hasn't been active for a few years. The one band that's interesting on here to me in particular is it's sort of a Halifax pop punk supergroup called Weekend Dads that are coming out to play it. And Weekend Dads are people that played in a bunch of like Ramonesy bands, like the Varsity Weirdos, who were active a few years ago. They kind of predated the whole Teenage Bottle Rocket thing, but had that same sound. But also folks from Future Girls, from Crosswires that are in that band. So a lot of bands that I listen to have people that are looped into Weekend Dads. But the other, that's kind of like the third group that you have that's playing Pooza are, a giant chunk of that lineup is always super local to Quebec and to Montreal in particular, kind of scene bands. Like bands that may never tour outside that area. And Pooza is kind of their chance to go and to, you know, be on the same bill as the Lawrence Arms or something like that. But you'll never hear about them kind of outside the area. And a lot of those bands will reunite to play Pooza, and I'm expecting to have a lot of those this year. So the two that you mentioned is that there's a kind of like a 2009 era hard. It's 2009 an era. I don't know. It's just 10 years ago. But yeah, there's circa 2009 hardcore outfit called Tightrope that's getting back together for a show there. And also a ska punk band called The Couch Addiction that's getting back to play a show there. I have no recollection of either of those bands, but they're there. So yeah, anyways, I don't know. That's who all is so far on the Pooza list. I have really weird beef with Pooza.
I've got a mild beef with Pooza.
I mean, your beef is probably more like on a taste standpoint. Like you're not interested in these bands that they're booking.
No, my beef with Pooza is that I interviewed Hugo Moody, who runs Pooza. Is that your beef? Go ahead.
No, your beef is that like Hugo is almost like difficult as sport. Is he not? Did he not just answer you in like terse grunts and
he's a combative, like years ago, about 5 or 6 years, maybe even like 10 years ago, like the Puza people reached out. They say, oh, do you want to interview Hugo of Puza? I was like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. At the time, I would like interview almost anybody. And I'm like, oh, so like, what are you like really looking forward to? And his answer was like, well, not anyone in particular. I'm like, all right, well what should people do while they're at Puza, but when the music's not happening? And he's like, well, there's lots of things. You can read a guidebook. I'm like, dude, I'm trying to get you to like kind of boost your own thing here. You're like fighting me every step of the way. Like, that's my beef with Puza.
He's just like lobbing him softballs and he just refuses to Yeah, so
Adam, you might remember we actually, when we did that funny listen to the Punk News podcast commercial, we actually did a parody of that, if you recall.
Yeah, I do actually. So I don't have that particular beef because I haven't had to interview Hugo. But no, mine is just that, like, it's not scheduled at a time when I, as a responsible dad, can go. So on the one hand, like, I've been to Puza. I've been there, like, as part of a little, like, punknews.org press contingent before. Puza was one of the craziest concert-going experiences that I've had, both for, like a personal reason and for, and just for kind of, like, just general crazy things going on in the world reason. So we were at Puza the year when the there were going to be tuition hikes in Quebec, and there were student riots in Quebec, like walkouts and stuff like that. And there were all sorts of things going on locally as part of that protest movement. Everyone, you know, you'd see people walking through the streets that would have, like, a little red square of felt kind of pinned to their shirt, and that was sort of like the universal symbol that you were with the students on what was going on there. But there was also there were parts of the protest where, you know, a certain part of the day, everyone would go start like clanging their pots and pans out the window, kind of thing. Like, it was strangely European in a way that the protest stuff was happening. But the students were really actively fighting with the cops at a certain point. Like, this escalated. So while Puza was on and we were there, there were lines of cops on horses marching through the street. There were tear gas canisters being chucked around and things like that. At one point while we were there, a bunch of the protesters like pulled a bunch of garbage into the middle of a major intersection and lit it on fire. And the response to that was, we're just going to tear gas the whole street corner. And this was a street corner where one of the venues where bands were playing at Puza was, and everyone had to like go out the back door of the venue to avoid getting tear gassed. But there was also like downtown restaurant patios and everything that were there that people were eating at, where there was tear gas flying around. So being able to come out of a punk show, I think it was like one of the Jesse Michaels bands played that year. Classics Love was there. But anyways, like you come out of this punk show and you look down the street and there's just like tear gas wafting around and horse cops all over the place. And just like visually, the whole thing was crazy. So that was cool. But also that was the being at Puza that year was very soon after I learned that I was going to be a father for the first time. And I hadn't told anyone.
But I knew.
No, I don't even know if you knew, because I told Punk News.
No, I did. You don't remember because you said to me, well, I don't have any kids yet. And I said, Adam, did you just admit to something? And you were like, no.
Oh, all right. There you go. But no, but so I hadn't told anyone overtly.
Astute listeners can go 6 or 7 years and listen to that episode where I catch on to that.
Yeah, go. That's a good use of your time. Anyways, though, but so me and Kira, who used to write for Punk News, has been on the podcast a handful of times. You know, we get up one morning and we went to, it was Concordia University, I think, in Montreal, and we went to the anarchist book fair that was there, and, you know, hung out there. And actually, while I was at the anarchist book fair at the university with Kira, one of the things that I bought was a book called My Mother Wears Combat Boots, which was written by Jessica. Let's see here.
Jessica Alba.
No.
Jessica Landry.
You're killing me.
Jessica Rabbit.
Jessica Mills.
Jessica Jones.
Do you know who Jessica Mills is, Mr. Throw references at me that I don't know? Do you know who Jessica Mills is?
I'm afraid I don't, honestly.
Haha. So Jessica Mills is sort of well-known amongst the Gainesville punk scene. She was one of the early members of Less Than Jake. She played saxophone for them. She left that band before their major label era, probably like pretty early in Less Than Jake's career, but she's contributed horns to everything. So any band that was kind of like out of that area that had someone playing sax on the record, it's probably Jessica Mills for it. So, the Against Me EP, the Disco Before the Breakdown, there is like a pretty rockin' sax solo that's part of one of the songs on there, either the title track or Tonight We're Going to Give It 35%, or one of those Against Me songs from that EP. And that's Jessica as well. So actually when at Fest a few years ago, when they performed Reinventing Axl Rose in its entirety, kind of like for the first time to much fanfare, they played the Disco Before the Breakdown EP as well as part of that. And she came on stage and played sax with them. So anyways, so she wrote a whole parenting book that was sort of sold through those alternate Rocky circles, like as an AK Press published book, if that means anything to you. And I bought a copy of that. Of course,
AK Press, who published the second edition of Nick Blinko's Primal Screamer book.
Ah, yeah, but I bought a copy of that. I bought a copy of a book called Rad Dad: Dispatches from the Frontiers of Fatherhood that has writing in it from, why did I buy that in particular? But it has, oh yeah, because there's an essay in there by Ian McKay, and a handful of other music people, I'm sure, that I'm not picking out of the list right now. But anyways, like, so I'm buying all of these like punk rock parenting books at the Anarchist Book Fair during Pooza. So I had to kind of reveal to Kira that oh yeah, we're expecting a kid. But my problem is that the Pooza Fest falls on this weekend in May, which we call the May 2-4 weekend in at least in Ontario, which is to say it is the weekend that contains the long weekend that is part of the Victoria Day holiday. So Victoria Day for us is May 24th, which doesn't always fall right on a weekend. So they kind of take the Monday or the Friday kind of closest to that and make that a long weekend, one of those deals. Well, that's the May 2-4 weekend. So I have two kids now. A long weekend in May, they're off school. I should be doing something with my kids, not like getting on a train and fucking off for 4 days so I can go see bands play. So on the one hand, Pooza has this amazing part of my, you know, of my brain because it's instrumental in me becoming a father. But on the other hand, now that I'm a father, I can't fucking go to Pooza.
Two questions. A, were any of those books actually useful whatsoever, or was it really just kind of chewing gum for the brain? And B, do you think we'll ever see Classics of Love play a live show or record ever again?
I mean, probably more chewing gum than not. I mean, any of the books that we purchased or picked up at the time, you know, in particular, the normal books that I didn't buy somewhere cool, were definitely not worth anything to us. That's not how you parent. You can't just like read books. You just fucking suffer and then you figure it out. And hopefully someone gives you advice. I feel like I read more of the punk rock parenting books than not, if only because I was in that headspace and I thought that, you know, this will give me the cool edge to be awesome dad. But no, they didn't. And it turns out a lot of the things that were in those books, I remember reading them and being like, I'm not doing that. Like that sounds counter to what I want to do. Oh, fuck, John. The other reason why Pooza was so important from this whole standpoint is that, I don't know if they do this anymore, but at least at the time, is they rented out an old school movie theater that's on St. Catherine Street in downtown Montreal. and Pooza just like plays movies the whole time, but like plays like music documentaries and stuff like that. And you could just kind of like walk in, get like a bag of popcorn and a beer, and you know, in the middle of like the hot afternoon or whatever, or you know, you're trying to nurse your hangover, you go in and you watch a movie. And one of the movies that was screening there kind of for the first time was that
I'm a punk and I'm a dad movie.
That I'm a punk and I'm a dad movie that had Lars in it. Whatever it's called. Was it called Punk Rock Dad? I don't know. Punk Dad? You know what I mean, people. And all of these
movie.
Yeah. And all these like all these punk people talking about like being parents. And so I'm right. I'm like, I am the target audience for that movie at that time. And I just kind of like sat there and just like, you know, drank it in this theater, you know, except that this is one of these movies that has like one or two people in it where I'm not sure exactly why they're in the movie. You know, we talked about like Dave Grohl a few weeks ago where he's always in everything. Where I think like in this one, the guy who is the singer to Everclear was in it a whole bunch. And I brought this up before and I got the answer from people who were like, oh, Everclear at one point in their life was kind of a punk band. And you just remember them because they had a one hit wonder kind of hit in the '90s or whatever. I mean, and that may be, but I don't know. This person seemed to be in there way more than I was prepared to accept that they were part of that conversation. So anyways, yeah, that's Pooza. So anyways, say Pooza's happening, Rebellion Fest is happening. The idea that we're announcing bands playing festivals in 2020, in December of 2019, seems a little unnecessary to me, but I don't know. I don't announce these things.
Well, I mean, one person pointed out that with the end of Warp, there is a festival void. However, I don't know, and actually they particularly pointed out Punk and Drublic, which has Circle Jerks playing, which is kind of cool. But I don't know if the Punk and Drublic audience is the same audience as Warped Tour. I kind of think it's definitely not, honestly. Like, I think the Punk and Drublic audience is Warped Tour 15 years ago audience. Those people, you know, not Warped Tour now.
Yeah, and that's to me, that's completely accurate. Like Punk and Drublic is what I would have envisioned Warped Tour of being when I was of the age where I should be going to Warped Tour. So, I don't know who appeals to the modern day, the latter day Warped Tour audience. Beats me.
Well, actually, that was his. He said that's the reason why he kind of closed it down. It's like it loses its identity, and the younger people weren't really into that kind of music, and the older people weren't coming out, and there's a lot of infighting between the bands, and it was just too much of a hassle for him because all people gave him was grief. So he said, well, what do I need this for? I've already got my millions of dollars. What do I care? I'm shutting it down. And that's why he shut it down. So, I mean, honestly, people bag on guys for, you know, overstaying their welcome, and not that I think Warped Tour was great, but he thought it was kind of declining, so he shut it down. So you got to give him credit there.
Hey, you know what? If you can't bring him out, you
shut it down.
You shut it down. You kill it. All right. Ooh, we're at over an hour. That's spectacular, given that we don't have a ton of content, apparently. All right. So let's touch on these three stories here, because I think they're all just sort of worth mentioning, but we there's maybe not a whole ton to discuss. So,
all right.
So item A, there's a new Iggy Pop video that you can go check. It's for the song Sonali. S-O-N-A-L-I.
Directed by Mac DeMarco, who is extremely famous, and I still can't figure out why.
I don't know who that is. It's great, eh? Like I know who it is. I think he even might be Canadian. Is he? I'm not sure. Let's see.
No, he's from LA. Yeah, he's from LA, I think.
No, he's from Canadian. He's from Canadian. He's from Canada. Oh. He's a Canadian singer-songwriter. He is an indie rock person from where? From British Columbia. There you go.
I can't figure out why. I mean, like, the kids love this guy. He sounds like Hall & Oates without the synths. Like,
Mac DeMarco is prevalent enough in the culture that he is the reference point for other artists. So you'll see artists described these days and they'll be like, oh, there's kind of like a Mac DeMarco vibe to this. And I read that and I'm like, I don't know who that is. And I'm Captain Canada here. Like, I should know who all these people are, but I have never brought myself to listen to a Mac DeMarco song. I don't know if I would enjoy him or not enjoy him.
Do you like John Mayer? You like John Mayer?
No.
You like Mac DeMarco?
Well, I mean, all right then. So that answers that question, I guess. So he directed this Iggy Pop video for Sonali. It has, would you say lizard people, John?
I think that's an homage to Iggy being the lizard because he was in the band The Iguanas before The Stooges. That's how I read it.
It either has lizard people in it, or it is it's a Star Trek tie-in because there's lizard people in it.
You think they're Xenu guys?
I don't know. I mean, like, what does a Xenu look like?
I think actually he's supposed to be like a big lizard kind of guy.
Mm. Do you know actually that there is a? It's always been rumored that Xenu was based on a '60s Marvel Comics monster called Zemu, like Zemnu or something like that. That sort of looks like a big white yeti with a beard and Viking horns. Back in the era before superheroes were sort of like every.
Is that Wendigo?
No, way before the Wendigo. But before the superhero era, when sort of like every comic that they would put out would just be like a different giant monster that people are running through the streets from. Back in that era, the Zemu was there, and this big goofy monster character was. Lines up pretty well with when L. Ron Hubbard would have been aware of that stuff and started sort of crafting his mythology. Sorry, which is to say, discovering the truth. But
we need to get rid of our Thetans. We got a lot of bad Thetans in us. We need to expel them by paying money to Scientology.
So there's this Mac DeMarco directed Iggy Pop video. It's super weird. It's from a song off Post Pop Depression?
No, it's off his new album Free, which he's not even really on, like all the tracks.
Yeah, all right. It's from Free. There you go. So go, you can go check that out. Item two, this new Rollins book that's out. It is called Stay Fantastic. It has 3 exclamation marks in the title, which makes me think this is a you book, John. It is Stay Fantastic Volume 1. It finds Henry discussing his rarest and favorite records. It includes a large archive of pictures of rare records, posters, and promotional items that he's collected. It's out now via his 213-61 label. He's currently working on a volume 2. John, this seems like your bread and butter, this kind of thing.
Well, see, that's the thing. It's like, do I really want to spend money just to see what records Henry has in his collection? You know, like, it's like, here's a picture of the first Buzzcocks record. Wow. You know, what he does have is he actually does have a lot of, like, very interesting, like, production type things. Like, one of the things he has is the original Bad Brains demo practice cassette that HR gave to him. So there's a picture of that. But I mean, like, do I need to see a picture of the Bad Brains demo cassette? Like, I can just see that on Discogs, you know? So, I mean, but on the other hand, that's kind of biased because if there was a book, it's like, let's look through Keith Morse's favorite records and he talks about them. I would definitely buy that. You know what I mean? So it just comes out of what it is. I think some people reading it as, you know, a dive into rare and obscure items and music, but that's not really what it is. It's hanging out with Henry for a couple of hours and Henry telling you about his favorite records. So, I mean, I'm sure he's got a lot of cool stuff because he and Ian MacKaye have the whole archival thing going on. So the answer is it's not worth $40 to me, you know. But if it was Keith Morris or Mick Jagger or Dave Brocky or Jello, it actually might be worth $40 to me, you know.
Oh, there you go. I'd be curious to see. I mean, if he's telling like if he's I would read a book if he's like showing some rare record and then like telling a story, either a personal thing or something about the record or band that's compelling to mention. If it's academic, then I don't know if that's necessarily what I want to read. Like, I don't need a compendium of I gotta need the paper version of Discogs, basically, which is what you said. Item number three.
Wow. Well, actually, well, and I'm not dissing, but I mean, honestly, I kind of feel like that would be better served as a documentary, not a book. But a book, you can fit a lot more information in than a documentary, too. You know, so I don't know.
Yeah. Item 3. Ellen Foley is going to star in a new musical performance, piece of musical theater, a play. It's called Club Dada, D-A-D-A. Club Dada in Difficult Time. The show co-stars Robert I. Rubinsky and is described as two ancient vaudevillians hang out in a world somewhere outside of space and time. A duo lost, trapped in memories of past glory. They keep hoofing and belting out tunes into eternity. So this only has one scheduled showing right now, which is at the... This is a live performance, right? So, like, yeah. Is showing the right word? I guess.
They were actually... Like, at first, I thought it was a play, but it's not actually a play. It's kind of like a night with. So it's not a live show where they just sing songs, but it's not a play either. They kind of talk, then they sing some songs, then they do like some skits or something, and they sing some more songs. So it's very much a classic showbiz vaudeville kind of thing, variety.
Well, whatever you call that, it is happening on December 7th at the 66 Wine Bar in New York City, and we don't know if it's happening any more than that. So now we get into the interesting part of this from our standpoint, I think, which is that, people know that Ellen Foley lent her voice to many sort of like mid to late period Clash tracks. Additionally, the Clash served as the backup band on her 1981 album, Spirit of St. Louis, which was produced by Mick Jones, who she was involved with at the time. And prior to that, Foley's first album was produced by Ian Hunter. And she's also well known for recording with Meatloaf. John, I don't think that before 25 minutes prior to the recording of this show, I had heard anything from Spirit of St. Louis ever. And I don't know why, because I knew that, it was her that was on all those later Clash things. I'm generally well engaged with Clash stuff that's out there, but this is one of these just like blind spots in my whole life. So I listened to Torchlight, and I'm into that. And now I kind of want to go hear the rest of this record.
Well, if you look at the credits to Spirit of St. Louis, it's a Clash record with her singing. That's what it, like, all the members of the Clash are pretty much on every track, which is crazy. And it's during the London Kong / Sandinista era, which is crazy. You know, honestly, though, like listeners shouldn't go expecting the long lost great Clash album. If anything, it's more akin to the Joe Strummer's first solo record, Earthquake Weather. And that's a little bit more sedate, a little bit more nuanced, I guess, and doesn't like rock out like London Calling or even like Give Him Enough Rope or something. But I mean, it's definitely the Clash making the sound that only the Clash can make that a lot of people aren't aware of. And Dad, or that, I always thought it was weird that Mick Jones and Ian Hunter, that Mick Jones is a huge fan of Ian Hunter, and they both went out with Ellen Foley. I thought that was kind of weird. You know what I mean?
Hmm. Well, you got to have a hero to look up to, I guess.
Yeah, but do you want to go out with your hero's girlfriend? I mean, that's kind of weird, I always thought.
I mean, if you're really trying to emulate that their life, I guess that's what you that's what you shoot to do. John, all right, so...
Paradise by Dashboard Light, Adam, Ellen Foley.
Is this one of these things where like we look at a story about Ellen Foley and we're always trying to like, use the Clash as the entry point to that, but any other person in the universe would be like, oh, Meatloaf collaborator Ellen Foley. Like, does Meatloaf command that much of the public's attention anymore? Does he live in their mind space?
I think more people know about Meatloaf than the Clash. You know, I mean, Bad Out of Hell 1 and 2 are some of the highest selling records of all time.
Right? So like, in a way, that's like we have like a really skewed perspective on what this person's place in the world is. When they die, their tombstone is going to say Meatloaf collaborator, not recorded a whole record with the Clash. I don't know why I'm putting so many things on people's tombstones tonight, but that's what's happening.
instead, what we do, like, we find someone that has like one tiny element of punk, and we're like, oh, and they did this huge great thing, and they're like, oh, but they also did this other thing too that we don't care about, you know. I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, well, one thing I was quite proud of when, well, not that I'm proud of, but when Larry Wallace passed away, which was sad, everyone else, like, original Motorhead member Larry Wallace passes away, and we're like, no, Deviants and Pink Fairy icon, who's also briefly member of Motorhead, passed away. You know what I'm saying? So.
Yeah, that's the way we roll, is we just ignore the popular context and just...
We just ignore the facts. We just ignore the facts.
Yeah, just massage the story into whatever we want. All right, here, we're done. This has been a long show for some reason. I'm going to play a song to get rid of us. So this song is called Big Mouth, but it is from a band... That was a weird sentence that I just structured there because I said, but it's from a band, which is to say, no, it is from a band. The song Big Mouth is from a band from Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. Not a province of Canada that I've had a chance to talk about on this show very much. It has red famous soil. Sorry, what was that?
Famous for its potatoes.
Famous for its potatoes, famous for its red soil, for its Anne of Green Gables-ness. So anyways, it's not a place with a huge population or anything like that. So you don't hear a lot of bands coming out of there. So anyways, one of them is Warsh, Warsh. Think of the word wash if you were trying to say it like a hick. So Warsh, they had this crazy killer demo that had been kind of like floating around the underground Canadian punk world for a good chunk of the year that everyone was really into. So they now have a little EP, 4-song EP that they've put out. It exists on a hand-numbered, handmade set of 100 cassette tapes, and I guess you can get it on the internet too. So Big Mouth is from that, and Warsh is great and fun and angry. That's what you want. You want the anger. Podcast@punknews.org is how you email us. Good night.